Hi, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific. I'm your host, Natalie Sambi. My guest today is Greg Raymond, a research fellow at the Australian National University. We'll be talking about the Thai military, why strategic culture matters, and how Thailand's coups have impacted on the military's development of its doctrine. But before we get into that, we'll be back after this short break.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
A country of 68 million people, Thailand is a key US ally. It's a member of the Association for Southeast Asian Nations and a growing strategic partner with China. It is Southeast Asia's second largest economy, and its economic importance is set to increase with the One Belt, One Road initiative. The country, however, has had a complicated history with democracy. The 20th and 21st centuries have seen 12 coups. In 2006, the military displaced the popular yet polarizing Thaksin Shinawatra. In 2014, the military stepped in again, taking power over from then-leader and sister of Prime Minister Thaksin, Yingluck Shinawatra. The country is currently led by a National Council for Peace and Order, headed by General Prayut Chan-o-cha, commander of the Royal Thai Army. Trying to make sense of this all is my guest, Greg Raymond, a research fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. He's currently working on a research project looking at Thailand, the United States and China. He is also converting his PhD thesis on Thailand's strategic culture into a book. His interest in one of Southeast Asia's pivotal states, however, didn't begin in the academic world.
I was really, really very fortunate in being sent to study Thai full-time for 1 year, as you mentioned. That was a tremendous opportunity. And then I had the additional luck of actually working in Thailand in the Australian Embassy in Bangkok for 4 years. So I really have to thank the Australian Department of Defence for that great opportunity. And also have to thank the manager, a particular individual, I won't mention his name for a risk of embarrassing him, but he really was very enlightened in deciding that a year of language training was worthwhile. And it certainly changed the experience for me. As you mentioned, I was representing defence and advising the Thai Ministry of Defence. So my job over there was really to try and set up cooperation as much as I could in those areas that you mentioned, covering defence science and technology, defence management, and towards the end, strategic policy as well. Not always easy, but when it came off, it was really, really rewarding. And somewhere in the midst of all that, I decided that I would take on a doctorate. I think I really wanted to make use of the language skills that I'd worked hard to acquire, and the idea of not having anything that I could use those language skills on after I came back to Australia left me feeling a little bit empty. So a doctorate was the answer to that. So pursued that, and in fact I graduated this year.
Congratulations.
That. So, yeah, so that's part of the... And towards the end of that doctorate, something else seemed to come up, and that was the opportunity of working over here at ANU on, as an academic on a great project to do with Thailand and how it's positioning itself vis-a-vis the US alliance, but also other great powers, and particularly China, of course. So that's the path that's led me to... where I am now and our discussion today. Yeah.
And it's interesting, as we get more into this podcast, we'll talk a little bit more about the Thai relationship with the United States and China. But just as an overview, I mean, for a lot of our listeners, many of them being based in the US, Thailand is a new country in terms of a research area. Just as a quick overview, it's a Buddhist majority country of 68 million people. It is also home to the world's longest serving monarch, King Bhumibol, or is also known as Rama the Ninth. But as you know, Thailand's politics have been characterized by, I mean, by some counts, 12 successful coups. And at the moment, we are currently in a phase where the military has been managing the country since May 2014. I just wanted to ask you, just to give our listeners a bit of an entree into Thailand, with the military currently being in power, can you just give us an overview of the current situation and what the implications have been for Thailand? Why did that happen?
Look, from the point of the country, they believe that the political conflict between the then Yingluck government and the protest groups had reached a point where that conflict was both irreconcilable and also in danger of escalation. So in the minds of the coup leaders, and in particular General Prayut, who was leading the army at the time, a coup was the only solution. The coup took place against a backdrop of several years of very bitter, bitterly contested politics in Thailand. And this really has been endemic, chronic since the 2006 coup, which deposed Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who's probably been both the most popular elected politician ever in Thailand's history and also the most divisive. And this division in Thailand has really been right across Thai society. It's been not only between different geographical regions of Thailand, but even within single families within urban Bangkok. Now, of course, the reason for the continued presence of the military, continuation of military government, it is speculated, and I think not without basis, that this is connected with an impending transition as the ageing and ailing monarch, King Bhumibol, who you mentioned, enters his twilight years. So there's potentially a wish for a closer grip on power during this period of uncertainty, because the monarch has been such an important anchor point for Thai society since the mid-50s, very long time, several decades.
And just to give a quick overview, you mentioned the Prime Minister that was removed by the recent coup, that's Yingluck Shinawatra. Can you just give us a quick sense of the kind of politics she had? Because obviously on the one hand there are the royalist nationalists who are in support of the king and the military, and then on the other side more populist forces, which I think in the past have been represented not only by Prime Minister Yingluck but her brother prior to that, Prime Minister Shinawatra as well, Thaksin.
Yes. Fair to say that it was Thaksin Shinawatra who introduced a whole range of populist policies, including very cheap 30 baht healthcare, loans for farmers. But it's also true to say now that those policies have become fairly mainstream and have not been rolled back. Although one policy, which of course is very strongly associated with the Yingluck government, is the rice pledging scheme, and that very much is being rolled back. So, I think it's fair to say that Yingluck was the inheritor of those sorts of populist policies. But it's also true to say that there's perhaps been some convergence on that. So it's really not so much policy or policy is certainly not the only element which has led to a division between these different sides of Thai politics.
And just before we delve a bit more into the military, I was hoping you could just give us a quick idea particularly related to the Minerva project, of the importance of Thailand, its strategic position on the on continental Southeast Asia, and its relationship with China and the United States.
Geostrategically, Thailand occupies a very central position. I think that sort of really applies both in a north-south sort of axis and also an east-west axis. It really is at a crossroads. It's at a crossroads between China and Southeast Asia, and I think Thailand's always been conscious of that, particularly in terms of trying to position itself as an economic hub. They really see a bright future for Thailand if Thailand becomes a hub of manufacturing, a logistics hub, and that's part of Thailand's interest in China's initiatives such as the One Belt, One Road project. But Thailand has also been important for the United States in terms of its operations, obviously during the Cold War against Vietnam, but also in recent decades, it's been important for US forces transiting to the Middle East. So it has it's a valuable piece of real estate and has been for a long time.
Certainly. As a key partner in Southeast Asia, it's important to understand Thailand. And obviously, as we've been talking about the political situation, a key piece of that puzzle is understanding the Thai military. Now, you've written a recent article about Thailand's coups. And as we said earlier, there's roughly about 12, depending on your account, that have been successful in the past. But it is not just the effect that they've had on the country's reputation, but you take a different angle. You argue that they're bad for doctrine, for military operations. And in order to better understand the Thai military, you've drawn on a range of methodological approaches, including the contested concept of strategic culture. So to set up this discussion, could you please give us a quick definition of what you mean by strategic culture and why you think it's still a useful concept for not only academics but policymakers as well?
Sure. Look, strategic culture, the simplest way to summarize it is it's about the presence of the past in the thinking of the present. So I particularly like Jack Snyder's definition. He was the RAND analyst who really brought the strategic culture concept into play in the thinking of international relations analysts and theorists. He was looking at the Soviet Union and particularly their thinking around nuclear deterrence and planning for the use of nuclear weapons. And he came up with a view that Soviet thinking was so deeply embedded, their patterns of thinking were so deeply embedded, they weren't just at the level of policy, they were at the level of culture. And this really has been the essence of the strategic culture project, as I wouldn't call it a discipline or a school, it's too diverse, but the strategic culture project ever since. It's a persistence of ideas and it's also the influence of ideas across time. So I think strategic culture is still useful because we know that a lot of mainstream international relations theory, despite decades of research, such as theories like neorealism, are still very limited when it comes to their predictive power. You can know what a state's attributes are in terms of their material power, and you can know where they sit in an international hierarchy or order, but that can only tell you so much about how they will make decisions in matters of war and use of force. And at the same time, knowing a country's history can only tell you so much. Strategic culture, as I interpret it, is about understanding what lessons elites are taking from their history and how they are then educating their citizens or educating their military leaders about those lessons. So it's about what they take from their own history. So strategic culture is about adding a layer of political analysis to historical analysis. I'm not saying that strategic culture is much better than other theories of IR in terms of prediction, but I think it can help us explain some phenomena which doesn't fit neatly into the neorealist worldview. For example, Germany and Japan, both very powerful states in the current era, but their strategic cultures shifted dramatically after their World War II defeats, and that has been partly why they are hesitant strategic actors, more hesitant than they might have been otherwise. So those sorts of cases, I think strategic culture can add a lot to our understanding. But I should say that there's a whole other dimension to strategic culture, and that's not just the ideas held by elites, but it's also about the culture of the armed forces themselves. Clearly, armed forces are important actors, and what they believe about their role and the way that wars will be fought will be critical in influencing how the state overall behaves in matters of war and force.
Just with regards to that idea of an armed forces, so strategic culture, as we understand it, relates to the use of force. Does it also relate to the military's role within politics?
Well, it may be that one strategic culture analyst will interpret strategic culture that way. In my work with Thailand, I've chosen not to. And this has been, you know, quite a conscious decision. I think that although the organisational culture of the Thai military is one input into their civil-military relations, I think civil-military relations in Thailand is more complex than that. I think it has to do with thinking about how the Thai state should be governed. And that's not only thinking coming from the military, it's coming from other elites, bureaucratic elites, royalist elites, who have beliefs about the way the Thai state should operate. And those ideas and their views are very influential of the way civil-military relations works as well. So, for example, there is a view that there is a Thai-style democracy in which, you know, you have the monarch as a constitutional head of state, but it's not the same sort of constitutional democracy that we imagine in the West. The monarch has considerably more role, and elected politicians have considerably less respect generally than what we're accustomed to perhaps in the West. So, I guess what I would say is, another analyst in another country might include, you know, the military's involvement in politics as part of that strategic culture. It's not the way that I've chosen to look at the Thai military, but I do think some aspects of their organisational culture, and in particular their royalism and their factionalism, have been factors leading them into politics.
Certainly. And just sticking with that analytical approach to strategic culture, when you were defining strategic culture, you gave some clues to methodology and data. You talked about the ways in which elites take lessons and then they educate and then transmit that history to their constituents as well as the military as well. For your particular research, or just research in general, when you're looking at strategic culture, how are you constituting culture? Because obviously we know that can be quite a fluid term, quite a contestable term. And then for your research in particular, what kind of primary sources have helped you construct that kind of education and that kind of interpretation of history?
That's a really important question and a very actually complex question. There's a lot of debate in strategic culture about what should be measured in order to derive a picture of a strategic culture. Now, I'm what I would describe as being a bit of a limited positivist in terms of strategic culture. I think that strategic culture writers like Alistair Ian Johnston, who want to see culture as an independent variable and try and measure its effect on the dependent variable, that is decision-making and behaviour, are on the right track, but I do think it's difficult to conclusively prove the influence of culture in given situations. So, you know, causality is hard to prove. But what I do like about, Alistair Ian Johnston is that he doesn't want to say every aspect of a country's history was a reflection of its strategic culture. Because then really everything's culture and you have an unfalsifiable hypothesis. And that's, it's not really scientific anymore. It's more like a religious belief. So I think you need to look at culture. How do you define culture? As you say, it's a slippery concept. It clearly has to do with meaning, symbols which have convey meaning to people, stories which convey meaning to people. So it's that kind of level of ideology and level of symbolism which is transmitted across generations. Now, I think the way to find that is to look at what people study when they learn about their own history. So the texts that they read, their school texts, but, you know, if it's a military institution, perhaps the military texts that they read. Alistair Ian Johnson in China looked at a set of military texts that were quite old but were always standard texts for Chinese military officers. I didn't find the same thing in Thailand. I found in Thailand it's much more about the royalist nationalist history, which everyone is immersed in. But I think it is important to look at what I call the cultural artefacts, that is actual documents that people write. I don't think it's a good idea to just look at that country's history and say, well, they've always done things this way, so that's their culture. I think it's important to look at the messages which are being internalised. And that, you know, means looking at their writing, their biographies, their memoirs, their propaganda, a whole range of things like that, yeah.
Yes, no, I mean, so let's start talking a little bit more about Thai strategic culture then. In your opinion, what are some of the main factors that influence current Thai strategic culture, and what are the main characteristics of that current culture?
Okay, well, I've interpreted Thai strategic culture at two levels. Firstly, the level of what I call politico-military ideas, and these are ideas about what makes a state secure? How do you find protection from the potential risks of the international environment? Now, and the other dimension of Thai strategic culture is to do with that organisational culture of the military. But just taking the political military ideas first, I think in Thailand's case, we have two main clusters of thinking, and I call these narratives or politico-military narratives. So I think these are very deeply rooted in Thailand's royalist nationalist history and ideology, and both of these formed during the process of state-making and the process of surviving encounters with colonialist powers that occurred in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The first narrative I call the fall of a Yutian narrative, because the symbol which captures the thinking in this narrative is the fall of the ancient city of Ayutthaya in 1765 to the Burmese. And Thais believe, and it's taught, that this city fell to a reasonably insignificant Burmese raiding party because there was disunity in the leadership in Ayutthaya. So the lesson here is that unity can protect you, that if you have unity, you avoid giving colonial powers a pretext to intervene. So that's quite an important sort of strategic lesson that's, epitomised or carried within the fall of a Ayutthaya narrative. The second narrative I call the Deeds of Chulalongkorn narrative, and this draws on two incidents from Chulalongkorn's own reign. The first was a defeat, and the second a triumph.
Oh, and just to clarify, King Chulalongkorn was a ruler of Thailand, Rama V, from 1868 to 1910. So he is the predecessor to the current king.
There were three Ramas between he and the current king.
Oh, sorry, not the direct predecessor, but yes.
He's an earlier, he's one of the Chakri dynasty, Rama V, correct, yeah. He's a very, very revered monarch in Thai history. It's really impossible to overstate how much he is still revered today, and that's part of the influence of these narratives. But he experienced a defeat and a triumph. in the course of Thailand trying to manage France's ambitions in the late 19th century. At this period, we have really the scramble for Africa, but we also have the scramble for Asia. And France and England, to an extent, are competing. It is a great game. In 1893, Thailand suffered a military defeat to France. And it was a huge shock to France because to that point in time, they believed that their mastery of diplomatic norms, of international law, and their opening to trade had immunized them from this type of depredation. But it hadn't, and France wanted something, and France was prepared to use force to get it. And they lost, they had to cede quite a deal of territory after this defeat called the Bac Nam incident in 1893. And this was a shock. And it convinced Chulalongkorn that Thailand really did need a military deterrent. And although he didn't react immediately, it was some 4 or 5 years later that he began to draw up plans to significantly expand the army to 10 divisions of 10,000 soldiers each. So it changed his mind. About military force, and particularly brought him to a point where he ignored the advice of the elites who wanted to say Thailand can survive through diplomacy alone. But the other part of the narrative is one of Chulalongkorn's triumph. In 1897, he decided he would embark on a trip to European capitals. Now, it's generally believed in Thailand that this was a huge triumph for Thailand, or Siam as it was then, in terms of convincing the world community that Siam deserved a place in the family of nations. It was developed, it was civilized, it deserved to be independent and respected. So for Thais, this conveys the importance of diplomacy. So overall, this politico-military narrative conveys two things, that diplomacy is very beneficial, but military force is still essential.
And I just wanted to pick up on those two narratives as well. In your article, you talk about their enduring character and the fact that even today there are references to the Bac Nam incident and the lessons of military force, but also the values of diplomacy. Can you just give me an example of how those narratives are manifested today as an example of how enduring they are?
Yeah. In researching Thailand's relations with the great powers, and on one of our recent field trips, we found a document in Chulalongkorn University Library, which was a conference record. And this conference record this conference was about how Thailand ought to manage, deal with great powers in the contemporary environment. And one of the keynote speakers whose speech was recorded was Surugyet, a guy called Surugyet, who was previously a foreign minister for Thailand, Surugyet Satirapan. And he was a foreign minister under Thaksin Shinawatra. He was also potentially at one stage a potential UN Secretary General. That's another story. He gave a speech where he talked about the importance of Chulalongkorn in his thinking when he was foreign minister and his balancing of the great powers. So this aspect of how do you survive great powers, you play them off against each other, you balance them, is still something which elites in Thailand strongly believe advantages Thailand. Leads them to a belief that they are well suited to managing in a multipolar geopolitical system. So Chulalongkorn's life and his accomplishments are still very influential today. There's no doubt about that.
And just to emphasise, we're talking about a monarch who was living in the middle of the 1800s to the early 1900s as still having a significant influence on Thai foreign policy and foreign policy thinking. Now, I just wanted to go a little bit deeper into what you think some of the implications are of those narratives within Thai strategic culture. Specifically, in your article, the puzzle that you're trying to address is that despite the strategic successes that Thailand has, as you mentioned earlier, maneuvering between the great powers and exhibiting defense diplomacy, it has a weakness, and it has an operational weakness that's related to its joint conventional military doctrine. I'm really interested in this, Greg. I was hoping you might unpack this for some of our listeners. Can you just make that linkage between what you've found with strategic culture and what you observe to be the current weakness operationally within the Thai military today?
Okay, sure. Look, before I do that, can I just make a couple of points about how I think these narratives have led Thailand to some strategic success during the 20th century? I'll just start off with that. I think that Thailand's strategic culture narratives have led Thailand to develop a fairly sophisticated use of diplomacy and force together. They've been able to coordinate the two in ways which have brought them considerable security benefits and economic benefits. And I think it was Rama VI, Vajiraput, Chulalongkorn's son, who first hit upon the idea of deploying the Thai military abroad for diplomatic benefit. And he did this in World War I when he ended Thailand's neutrality and decided to enter the war on the side of the Allies. And he did this after the US had entered, but it was a significant decision. And he sent a small force, aviators and ambulance drivers, to France to fight on behalf of the Allies. This had very, very positive flow-on effects for Thailand. It led to greater acceptance of Thailand, or Siam as it was then, as an independent state. They were able to be represented at the Paris Conference in 1919. It also led to Western powers gradually agreeing to relinquish the unequal treaties that they had signed with Thailand during the 19th century. So I think this conscious coupling of diplomacy and force, of using your military as a diplomatic tool, was something that then entered, Thai elite thinking. And I think it's present when people in Songkram in 1950 decides to commit Thai forces to fight in the Korean War under the UN flag, but also opening up what was a very important alliance with the United States. Now, there was a 25-year period of enmeshment with the United States, a very close alliance, that to some extent tapered off after 1975. But I think it had overall huge benefit to Thai economic growth and development, such that Thailand is today ASEAN's second largest economy. I'm not saying there weren't some negative legacies, but it's also had some very positive benefits. However, in terms of strategic culture and the Thai military's operational proficiency, I think essentially they haven't been able to achieve the levels of capability that are commensurate with their funding, commensurate with their good levels of equipment. They have excellent, generally they've been able to acquire pretty advanced, capable weapon systems. But their performance has not always been at the same level. And I think this is essentially because they are too divided. We have a complex and what I think is a destructive governance feedback loop operating here. I think militaries which have strong governance from a central government are more likely to develop unified doctrine, are more likely to develop high levels of jointry, and they're more likely to be efficient in their use of resources. But because the Thai military constantly intervenes in government, there is no central government that wants to tell them what to do. No government tries to govern them or direct them. And so this really leaves the military, and particularly the services, able to pursue separate agendas. And it means that there's not a lot of impetus for developing joint doctrine. And you have the Air Force preferring to use the doctrine of its US counterpart, which is not about supporting the army, whereas it might be more beneficial if the Thai Air Force had a doctrine which was more about mobility for the army than about strike or air defence necessarily, although that might be part of the doctrine. So this lack of central governance has real consequences. So The question then becomes, why does the Thai military intervene? And this is a question that I think comes back to their organisational culture. They are royalist, and factionalism is very strong. Royalism means that they value the monarchy far more than they value the parliament. I think this is very very well summed up when General Prem said in 2006 that in relation to the military, the government and the monarchy, the military is like a horse. The king is the owner and civilian government is merely a jockey. And this conveys that the civilian government sort of transitory. It's a transient thing. The monarchy's relationship to the horse, to the military, is far more enduring and far more substantive. So that royalism is a powerful influence, but also factionalism. With each coup, a certain gear level of class group, and then this relates to the educational system of the Thai military, will move into top positions. And sometimes they will leapfrog colleagues who may have been ahead of them in terms of seniority. So there are winners and losers often in each coup. And often the groups which have been disenfranchised, have missed out, are then incentivized, or have an incentive later on to attempt their own coup because they would like to also secure the benefits of office. And this is probably a dynamic which was much stronger in the 60s, 70s. It's tapered off now, but I think it's too early to say that it's disappeared.
So, Greg, just to sum up what you were talking about just now in terms of the main characteristics of the organisational culture, what does that mean in terms of operational weakness? What's the link there?
First, doctrine. Doctrine really important for modern militaries. It means that there'll be a basic level of operational understanding that will lead such things as exercises, such things as training, such things as acquisition of equipment. If there's a shared doctrine, there's more likely to be harmony in the way the different arms of the armed forces train, exercise and procure. And that all leads to better performance in military operations. If you look at, the German army's performance in World War II with the Blitzkrieg doctrine, it was the result of the tremendous coordination between the air and land arms, which allowed Germany to make such rapid advances during that conflict. In Thailand, we've not seen the same level of doctrinal development. It's been difficult for the Thai military. On the one hand, they have adopted a foreign doctrine from the United States, and before that, they tried several other nations' doctrines. And they've also had a significant counterinsurgency role, which wasn't one that they grasped or embraced readily, but in the end, in the 1970s and 1980s, they did develop a coin doctrine. Then they attempted to develop a sort of synthesis of conventional and coin doctrine, which they call the total warfare strategy. These haven't been terribly successful in terms of developing conventional doctrine that really is effective. And this was shown up, I think, during a conflict they had in the 1980s against the Lao military. The Lao military at that stage, although there was some support from the Soviet Union, really wasn't as well equipped, had a much smaller defence budget, was a much smaller military, and yet they managed to inflict very serious casualties on the Thai military in a border dispute at a place called Ban Rom Glau. And much of the problem for the Thais was a lack of coordination between air support and the ground forces, a lack of intelligence that was useful for that operation. Logistics was not optimal, and command and leadership was not optimal either. And that's another thing that I haven't mentioned about so far. I think one of the problems leading from poor governance is that promotion is not necessarily always on merit in the Thai personnel system. Even to this day, the Defence Act in Thailand doesn't give the central government or the civilian government the final say on who gets appointed to leadership positions. There is a defence council on which military people hold the majority of the places. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be problematic if there's a culture of promotion based on favours. And I'm not saying that's always the case in the Thai military, but certainly it's perhaps more prone to people being promoted on criteria other than merit. And factions also can be a problem in terms of the unity within the Thai forces. And this was shown up by some work done by a Singaporean academic called Terence Lee, who looked at the way the Thai military behaved in managing two protests. Now, in 1973, the Thai military was extremely divided, and they refused to act, obey the command of their commanders, which was, you know, a good thing in terms of Thai democracy and the lives of those students, but it's a worrying thing from the point of view of military efficiency. They didn't have the same problem later on in 1992, and that was because the factions weren't dividing the Thai military so much at the time. So factionalism can also be an effect on leadership. So those two things together, factionalism leading to divided unity of command and factionalism leading to a lack of development of appropriate doctrine, I think together mean that even if you're well-equipped, you're not always going to perform as well as you could on the day of a conflict.
Greg, just extrapolating upwards and taking a bit of a big picture view then. So we've talked a little bit about the history and the genesis of some of the main narratives within Thailand's strategic culture as originating with Chulalongkorn, who was the king in the 1850s till the early 1900s, to the way in which that affected the thinking about foreign policy, the eminence of deterrence, but the importance again of engaging in diplomatic acts, to the also then developing the idea that the military has a special relationship with the royal family and that the parliament was perhaps a bit more extraneous to that fundamental relationship. And then you talked a little bit about the factionalism as well and the ways in which that has a very real, a very pragmatic effect on the operational effectiveness of the Thai military, over its history. It's often difficult to transplant lessons from one country's particular experiences to another, but I was hoping we could attempt that by thinking about what lessons you think the Thai military and its strategic culture has had for understanding other militaries. And I ask this simply because, as we both know, in Southeast Asia, we've had militaries who have engaged in the political realm, and I'm thinking about Indonesia and Myanmar, amongst others. But perhaps what lessons Thailand may reveal for smaller states in the international realm as well.
Yeah. Look, I think the point about strategic culture is that it is really about unique, discrete political systems. And so I don't think it does lend itself readily to generalising from one state to another. However, I think there's a couple of points that come to mind when I think about things that I've observed in Thailand and things that I've observed, I guess, in other parts of Southeast Asia, not only Southeast Asia, East Asia more generally. And I think there's a couple of points we need to look at. One is that I think there's a fundamental importance of post-colonial ideologies in East Asia. Contact with the West and being forced to become a Westphalian state in one way or another has been a painful, difficult, traumatic process and very formative process for nearly all states in East Asia, and probably not only East Asia, probably other parts of the world, Africa, South America as well. But and I think this applies whether or not there was colonisation. Regardless of whether or not colonisation occurs, there still had to be a process of deciding a governmental system, developing a military force that would provide a monopoly of force within that defined territory. And the movement from the much more loosely the looser political systems which predated the Westphalian state system to the system of Westphalian states which has eventually emerged in East Asia is something that's occurred in every one of the states. And what's been the fallout in terms of the ideologies which have developed and the political systems which have developed is something which will bear the imprint of that period. So I think that's it gives us, a clue as to where I think we should look when we're looking for strategic cultures in the systems. So, you know, there will be some influence from earlier pre-modern periods, but that influence had to be somehow packaged and disseminated, and that happens through the systems and processes of a Westphalian state.
Greg, your school had recently celebrated the 50th anniversary, and in Canberra there was a large conference held. And just to follow on from that point about the particular experience that colonised countries have had and some of the post-colonial thinking that that's given rise to, there have been some scholars that argue that we could talk about an Asian school of strategic studies. What's your reaction to that thought?
My reaction is that a lot of what purports to be, a universalist theory of strategic studies, it just often underrates the importance of states entering the state system in that post-colonial era or even earlier in the case of Thailand and Japan. I think there's a tendency to just overlook how important those experiences were. So in as much as an Asian school of strategic studies places more importance on those experiences, then I think it's valid. But, I'm really reluctant to talk about things like that get too... That perhaps put too much emphasis on unique qualities of Asia. And let's not forget that Asia is a construct in itself. I do think that there are universal aspects of international relations, but I also think there are particular aspects, and I think it's useful for people like Amitai Vacharia and others to balance, the sorts of universalist pretensions of some of the theorists such as Waltz and whoever, who may just not adequately weight those factors. And I think people like Alistair Ian Johnson, I think, do adequately weight them. So it's not you don't have to have, come from an Asian state in order to appreciate what's going on over here. Yeah.
And Greg, final question. For the day. You mentioned Alistair Ian Johnston, but apart from academic texts, which scholars and other thinkers have had a lasting impression on you and why?
Look, I did a course on the social theorists Weber, Marx and Durkheim when I was doing my undergraduate years, and look, those thinkers took me away from the physical sciences. I'd previously been doing physical sciences, and Weber's explanation of the origins of capitalism based on the influence of ideas, the Protestant ethic, that captured my curiosity, and it helped me understand the society in which I live. So that was tremendously influential. Since then, it's been Francis Fukuyama. I think he's been a real inspiration. His breadth of vision, his capacity to explain the political institutions in which we live in a very clear, evidence-based way. Yep.
Excellent. Greg, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us your deep knowledge of not only Thai strategic culture but the Thai military. And to all of our listeners, if you're interested in Greg's research, you can follow him on Twitter at Gregory V. Raymond. And you can also catch other episodes of Sea Controls Asia Pacific at simsec.org or follow us on Twitter at CIMSEC. Greg, thanks very much for joining us again. And to all our listeners, thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks very much.